As I mentioned in the intro to this module on reliability testing, it's fun. And there's also lots of different ways to do testing. And there's lots of different terms, and some of which we may use slightly differently. So you got to keep a fairly open mind and basically understand the basic concept of what the test is, or the types or approach of tests, so that you, one, you can select the right test for your particular application and what kind of decision you're trying to make. And two, is that on the exam, you have some idea of which types of terms may apply. Now, as we go through this, if you hear me describing a type of test, but you would call it something differently, add that to the comments. It may help everybody understand that these tests have a range of different names. And I know that's certainly true. So the first one we'll talk about is called a demonstration test. And that's, now I've seen this in military applications or with products that have a relatively short expected lifetime. Now, oftentimes it's repairable systems, say a tank vehicle or a helicopter, for example. Is if you operate one of those for a month, it's most certainly going to have a failure of one or more kinds of failures within that month. In the demonstration test is basically saying, if I run it for this discrete amount of time, I should expect some number of failures or less. And also we would use that information then, the number of failures over the time run, to do some reliability estimates. And there's a variety of ways to do that. In other cases, you may have a longer period of time, but it's usually either at nominal conditions or at kind of the upper level of use conditions. So like that tank example, they may have a test track that uses some of the worst terrain and types of conditions that they would expect. Or they may run the test in different parts of the world in order to have it experience different kinds of climates and weather and terrain. And the idea is that can it perform its function? So that may be pushed to the edge of where it's expected to perform, but also is it able to do so long enough? And usually there's no acceleration typically, so that the analysis of the testing is usually pretty straightforward. And that's what we commonly call a demonstration test. Oh, one other thing that it may be used for is a customer may require that you show them that it works. And they may set up a set of criteria that they want the product to go through through its paces, for example, and through its different sets of functions and different environments and stress levels in order to see if it's still functional, if it survives that. In some regards, that would be considered a demonstration test. Another one is what we would, our quality organization colleagues would probably call a qualification. If the specification is clear, as it should be, and if you've planned your reliability program well, and then we take some samples and we measure the performance, the reliability, for example, does it meet that specific performance? So if we want 98% of the units to survive for 3 months, well, let's take 100 units and we have 98 or more survive 3 months, then we've met the qualification requirements. In some cases, this is pretty practical. In many cases, it's not. But again, it's usually at nominal conditions or at specified conditions in the specifications. So it's a way to get some information about how well our product works. Now, if you remember back to the lesson on the quality function deployment, we've tied some of these user requirements and engineering specifications to other lower level specifications or settings, machine settings, and so on. So we may find a critical to reliability aspect of say a part or a flange or a component, and we're able to make sure that it's within specifications, basically qualifying that component or subsystem. But it has an impact on our overall reliability because that variability is what we're concerned about, for example. So there's a couple of ways of going about doing that from a qualification type approach. Performance testing is similar again to a demonstration test, but it's basically, can it withstand the load? Can it go fast enough? Can it do its functional elements correctly? So there's all kinds of different ways that we would evaluate this from a reliability point of view. My classic example I'm thinking of is that we want to compare our analytical models to the actual performance. So I'm thinking of the new composite wings that Boeing was putting on airplanes a few years ago. And the internal modeling was fairly extensive, and they came up with an estimate of when they would expect the wing to break under a specific load. So they made a wing structure and took it to the lab, and this is pretty elaborate because it's a big structure, and very carefully bent it, the wing, until it broke. And from what I understand is that it broke at a much higher load than they expected, about a 20% higher than expected, which meant that they over-designed it just slightly. But they were comparing the performance in using a test of failure kind of scenario in that particular case to find out if their model was correct. There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't necessarily have to be test of failure. It's performance testing could involve the various specifications about how a product should function, and just to make sure that that works. I equate this also to environmental testing. So will your car start in a cold day in Alaska, or will its air conditioner work adequately on a hot day in Florida? And those kinds of criteria. Another element that we often do is we set up a test where we really don't want any failures. I call it failure-free testing. It's got a variety of different names. You can also call it success testing if you're a glass half full type person. And the equation on here is based on a binomial distribution. It basically says if I can calculate how many samples I need based on the confidence and reliability, and it's the lower bound for the reliability, if I'm running the test for one lifetime. And if M equals 1, then the test conditions replicate one lifetime. The beta is like a Weibull distribution beta parameter. And so if I'm running, say, 2 lifetimes and my beta is 2, meaning it has a wear out mechanism, then it really cuts the number of samples I need down. And so it has some advantages there. But oftentimes we set up and run a test that just, say, is a simulating the transportation of from the factory to the customer series of experience. And this equation would then basically say, if we want to prove that 90% of our products will survive the shipping shock and vibration environment with 90% confidence, then we would run some number N, which in this case would be 22 samples. I happen to remember that as an example I've used pretty often. But I would run 22 samples through the experience of a typical or a worst case type shipping scenario. And if they all survived, then I could say with 90% confidence that at least 90% of the population's units will survive shipping. Now you can see right away that there's do I use nominal values or worst case values? Am I doing lower limits? And how many samples do I need? What's my risk that I'm willing to take for the sample representing the population? What do I know about wear out mechanisms or not? And on and on and on. And this is a good place, probably the first mention, that whatever test we're doing, we need to make sure that we're focused on, well, how does this stress cause failures for the product? Is it, are we focusing in on a particular failure mechanism, or are we, a different process is to look for failures and discover what they are, but that's more like a halt test. So anyway, success testing or this failure-free testing is pretty economical. it's for a given confidence and reliability, it's the minimum number of samples that we could run. Now, if we allow failures to occur, it improves the ability of the test to detect a difference between, say, 2% and 5% failure rates, but it does take more samples. Another purpose for testing in reliability testing is screening. So there's a couple stages of this. One is we may ask vendors to screen their products, their components before they ship them to us, either because they have a poorly controlled manufacturing process, or there's a lot of variability in the process, or the types of failures we're looking for are unique, and we need to add this layer of protection. It's not usually a very good thing to do, as it's expensive, and oftentimes the failure rates we're looking for are very small. But if we're looking for those failures so that we can do a detailed failure analysis and sort them out, screening may get us by until we can solve the problem. Likewise, on our own production line, if we're looking to precipitate specific failures because of manufacturing variability or some elements that we cannot control, screening may be a solution, but again, it's expensive and we should work to minimize the amount of screening we do. There's also development tests. Oftentimes we call this prototype testing. Now, in some cases, the first prototypes really don't need any stress, and hopefully they'll work long enough so that the various design teams, including the software team, can get their functionality work and experiments done. If we're lucky enough to get some of those early units for reliability testing, they are really just to focus in on questions that the development team needs to answer. In one regard, it might be what's going to fail, but it also might be focused on, is this vendor better than the other one in this particular application? And it could run the gamut of all kinds of different specific tests that we would lump under development tests. And another way of looking at testing and the types of work that we may do would be in working to set the appropriate tolerances. Some years ago, when I was back working in that polymer factory, we knew that some of our products, as their final configuration is where we measured their performance, had a lot of variability, and in some cases affected our yield. The amount of scrap that we would create was pretty variable. So we looked at the basic polymers we were dealing with in the manufacturing processes, and basically every step of the way. And I wasn't working with the polymer itself and with it was DuPont that was making the base resins for us. And what we worked on was setting tolerances, not on some aspect of the polymer of its performance in the extruder or its initial performance as a manufactured material. But polymer characteristic. But we were looking for is tolerances that actually had an impact on the final reliability. And so it was, again, thinking of that house of quality, we were connecting the specific information of what we were trying to purchase as raw material based on its effect on the performance of the final product. And so mechanical systems do this all the time. Here in polymer systems, because of the amount of processing we did, it was very difficult to set appropriate tolerances for the base material. Yet that was an interesting project while I got to work on it. Another type of testing, and we'll talk some more about this one in a later lesson, is attribute testing. So not everything has a continuous variable to measure, like time or time to failure. Some things are either just pass-fail, one-use items, either work or don't work when they're placed in demand to be used, for example. So it may be pass or fail or go, no-go type characteristics. And a lot of the lot sampling types of things and binomial or hypergeometric will come into play here as we design those tests. One caution, though, is that if you ever get the chance to use a variable instead of an attribute, do so, because it usually leads to a lot more information out of the same number of samples. So, but in some cases, we have to make measurements based on attribute data, and there are a range of tests that allow us to deal with that. The list just keeps going, doesn't it? Another is the classification. And so this is similar to attribute data, maybe a subset of that, is the different characteristics of a product. And it might be the colors, it might be the range or its performance in different categories or its configurations and so on. But functional performance is, and it might be under a range of different environments, is, well, what's the distribution of its performance? So if I'm looking at a cell phone, what's my transmit power characteristic in a variety of different circumstances and situations? So I may end up with like a log normal distribution describing the power output of my antennas. And that's one of the characteristics of the phone function. You can go over a whole range of different types of products and their characteristics, but then characterize those and put them into distributions when you can. In some cases, it's attribute type data, and so the classification might be using attribute data, or different I'm trying to avoid words that are right off the title here, but that's all that's coming to mind, is instead of measuring in millimeters the length of screws, they may be easier to classify them into short and long screws, for example, is a simple example. But it's another whole style of testing that allows us to get some information. I don't use this one that often in my reliability work, but we'll probably see some more about it later. One of the questions that we have to deal with in setting up and planning our tests, and it dictates to some extent this type of testing that we're doing, is, are we sampling, getting a small set? And this really applies when the testing itself is destructive, or it's time consuming, or is some form of resource intensive. It's either a lot of people or a lot of facilities to do the testing. So in those cases, sampling may be the appropriate way to approach running our tests versus doing 100%. Now, if you're making a component and you can measure the key parameter very, very quickly, you may do that right in line on your production floor and do 100% testing. But if you had to destructively test those samples in order to understand their reliability performance, say you had to age them in some harsh environment in order to understand its reliability performance, you wouldn't want to do that on 100% of your units because you wouldn't have any units left to ship. So sampling in that case is your only option. So depending on the actual physical manifestation of your test, destructive versus not destructive, for example, or something that ages the product versus doesn't cause corrosion or degradation or deformation of some sort, may dictate what style of testing you're going to do. In the planning stage, one of the key steps is to understand what exactly are you going to do for the testing. Make sure you have the right equipment, the right preparation, data collection capabilities, and so on. Simply throwing some items in a chamber and coming back in a week and pulling them out and seeing if they work may or may not actually be terribly useful. And thinking that through and what information do you need to gather or should gather so that you can form conclusions later. So test procedures is a pretty decent practice. Now, I often start with standards. There's all kinds of different procedures out there for making measurements and evaluating things. And it gives you a pretty good checklist, basically, of what other people have considered appropriate for making these measurements. And make sure that your measurement system is adequate to the task at hand. You're not introducing too much measurement error and all those kinds of things. But think through the procedures so that, one, you can have it documented and compare, present the results, but have the procedure for creating those results available, for example. But more importantly, to make sure that as you get up and ready to start the test, you realize that you don't have an adequate power supply to power all the units, for example. The thinking through the procedure and all the requirements is a really good step to avoid those problems. One note, and I'm going to probably say this a few times as we go through this section, is whenever possible, test the failure. There's a couple of real advantages to that. One is that we get a failure. We get to know, did the stress where we apply to the product actually excite something that would lead to a failure? And so if we're if we take a product and put it on the bench and turn it on, and after a week it doesn't fail, well, we probably expect it to keep working, but we don't understand, we don't have any information about shipping or transportation or shock or load or thermal cycling or on and on and on, all these different stresses that would cause the product to fail. Now, in some cases, if we don't think through what we're looking for and we test the product at high temperature, for example, but only thermal cycling would really cause a failure, we may pass, here's some air quotes for you, the test and believe we've got a 20-year product. And then they all fail in 3 years due to thermal cycling. So really think through the types of failure mechanisms, the FMEA, all the risk analysis work that we do up front, and evaluate those failure mechanisms to, well, what stresses would excite them? So the classic example is just temperature or temperature cycling. If you do the wrong stress, you won't excite the failure mechanisms that you're interested in exciting. And so by testing to failure, it gives you failures that can allow you to confirm that you've got the right stress to excite the failure mechanisms you're expecting. Second, if you are testing to failure and the failure is completely different, has a completely different root cause than what you expect, well, then you learn something. You've been surprised. And so the part I don't like about success testing is that you don't get failures to confirm that your test is doing the right thing and stressing your product appropriately. But it also, it's not as fun, but it also doesn't allow you to be surprised as easily. Sometimes we can set up a success test that's so benign that it's going to be very unlikely that anything would fail. And at the end of the day, what does that really mean to us? What information do we really gather from such a simple test? So, yes, it costs more and it takes more time and work, but you get way more information. Not only that you get actual failures you can investigate, you get confirmation your test was evaluating the product appropriately. Degradation tests. Not all products fail catastrophically. You know, when I start my car and it just doesn't start, the starter's failed and it just won't turn over the engine, that's not degradation testing. Whereas the tread on the tires on my car slowly erode away. And eventually it crosses the threshold where it's considered bald. And it's literally not safe to drive those tires without the tread on them. Other things that have mechanical wear, say, the brake pads on those on my car. They're designed to erode the brake pad as they cause braking. And every time you brake, you lose a little bit of that brake pad. Once it gets down to a certain point, it becomes dangerous to use that brake pad. That's why they put metal bars inside of the pads so that it'll make a horrible sound when it's getting close to being too thin and becoming dangerous. So in that case, the rate of wear is something that we can measure by putting some brake pads on cars and run out and do so many different styles of speeds and hardness of braking and so on, and then measure the brake pads some more, or give the cars to regular customers and measure the brake pads every 1,000 miles, for example. Create a relationship between miles driven in normal conditions versus the rate of wear of those pads. That's a style of degradation testing. Truncation tests. There's time truncated and failure truncated. And we talked a little bit about this when we talked about MTBF earlier in one of the earlier lessons. Is you can set up a test such that once you get 3 failures out of 10, you end the test. It's a failure truncated test. Another style of test is it'll run for 100 hours or 168 hours a week. And then you end it on that time mark, and that would be a time truncated test. So there's a couple different techniques for doing that, and we'll see some more of those calculations for these truncation type things in one of the next lessons in this section, dealing with sequential testing. Now, I'm fully aware that that's not a complete list, and I talked about different approaches to testing, different types of testing, plus a few considerations in there. So there's lots and lots of things to consider as you go about the business of breaking things. So next we'll talk about a little bit about the people involved and the effects that humans have on testing, and also testing of the human factors involved with testing or product performance, I should say.